This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. Now, what if I told you that lung cancer hits non-smokers too? For decades, we've been thinking that lung cancer is synonymous with people who smoke. But the profile of people newly diagnosed with lung cancer may be changing. So I'm going to explore the rise of lung cancer among smokers with my guests today who are joining me via Zoom, Dr. Anand Sachidanandan, consultant cardiothoracic surgeon and also president of the Lung Cancer Network Malaysia, as well as Dr. Jamalul Azizi, consultant pulmonologist from Hospital Serdang. How are the both of you today?
Good afternoon, Xiaoyik. Very well, thanks. And thank you for kindly having us again.
Thank you so much for your time. Yes. Like I said, we want to discuss, you know, why lung cancer is rising among non-smokers. I want to get some insights from you, Dr. Anand, about how or whether artificial intelligence has the potential to improve a lung cancer screening. And, you know, from the both of you, how the pandemic has affected lung cancer patients in terms of diagnosis, treatment services, and, of course, people's outcomes. So for those of you listening, our lines are open, 03-7733-2900 is the number to call if you have questions or anything you'd like to share with our guests today. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Dr. Anand, perhaps we could start with an update from you in terms of our national lung cancer statistics, you know, just to refresh our memories on how common is lung cancer and how does it rank among other common cancers in Malaysia?
Yeah, sure, Sherry. I mean, I think firstly, if we look globally, you know, lung cancer is possibly the second most common cancer overall. Only in the last year, it's been surpassed by breast cancer. But globally, approximately 2 million cases are diagnosed each year, and approximately 1.8 million people with lung cancer die from the disease each year. Now, a majority of these cases are in Asia. Approximately 60% of all cases are in Asia. If we hone into Malaysia, you know, the most contemporary data is from our National Cancer Registry report, which was published in 2016. This is a five-yearly report that comes out from the Ministry of Health through the National Cancer Institute, IKN. We know that lung cancer is, you know, one of the commonest cancers in Malaysian men. It's marginally surpassed by colon cancer and accounts for 9.8%, almost 10% of all cancer in Malaysian males is lung cancer. But it is the commonest cause of cancer death, cancer-related mortality. Around 1 in 5 to 1 in 4 cancer deaths in men in this country is attributable to lung cancer. For women, as everyone knows, breast cancer is the most common cancer. You know, lung cancer is the joint fourth most common cancer after breast cancer, colorectal cancer, cervical and uterine cancer. So it's about 5.6% of all female cancers is due to lung cancer, but it's only surpassed by breast cancer in terms of fatality. So it's the second commonest cause of cancer death in Malaysian women. So I think from that, we can just infer we're talking about a common cancer and a common cancer killer, cause of cancer-related mortality. Just the other statistic I want to share with you, Sherry, before we can discuss further with Dr. Jamalul, is the fact that we are burdened with a lot of late-stage disease presentation in this country. Almost 95% of all cases of lung cancer are being detected too late in Malaysia. You know, that's in stage 3, what we call as locally advanced, or stage 4 metastatic. So we're too late in the game, and consequently, that's translating into worse outcomes. You know, lung cancer is the worst performing of all the major cancers in terms of what we call it, five-year relative survival. If we take all four stages and lump it together, the five-year survival is dismal. It's just around 11%. So we really have to up our game.
And Dr. Jamal, sorry, you'd like to add, Dr. Jamal?
Yeah, if I can add, there's a couple of things. Lung cancer, I mean, locally in Malaysia, lung cancer is the third most common cancer. I think the top one is breast cancer, followed by colon cancer, and then lung cancer. And as Dr. Anand said, lung cancer carries the worst prognosis, the worst outcome among of among all cancers in Malaysia, lung cancer has the worst outcome.
And Dr. Jamalo, you know, I want to go straight into that point I introduced the show with about the distinction between smokers and non-smokers getting lung cancer. Do we know a proportion how many of lung cancer patients are actually smokers or were smokers? Why do we say that lung cancer is rising among non-smokers?
All right. I think if you look at the data in the U.S., about 10 to 20% of the lung cancer cases occur among non-smokers. Okay, so meaning that about more than 80% of their cases of lung cancer cases occur in smokers. You know, but things are different. The pattern is different in Asia. We have seen the pattern change over the last 10 years or so, where, you know, during my time, you know, we saw a trend where, you know, we saw a rise in, lung cancer among non-smokers. Really. See, so I think the proportion of lung cancer among non-smokers is higher in this part of the world, in Asia or in Malaysia in particular. You know, if in the US it is about 10 to 20%, I suspect, I've searched hard for the data, I just couldn't find the exact figure, but I suspect is, you know, the proportion of percentage of lung cancer in non-smokers in Malaysia is probably, you know, around 30 to 40% actually, you know.
That's shockingly high.
Yeah.
Dr. Anand, why might that be the case?
Yeah, Sherry, if I can just add, you know, I completely agree with what Dr. Jamalullah said. You know, we don't have data for Malaysia, what proportion of lung cancer victims or patients are non-smokers. But from our anecdotal experience, you know, for those of us in the specialties treating lung cancer patients, as Dr. Jamalullah said, you know, it's probably in the order of 20, 25, even 30%, possibly more. I can share with you, like in Singapore, I don't know whether we can extrapolate from there, the population is demographically a bit different. Almost one in two of all cases of lung cancer in the non-smoker or never smoker, and that's similar in Taiwan, but I guess they have a slightly higher proportion of ethnic Chinese compared to here in Malaysia. But we reckon at least 25-30% maybe, you know, in the so-called non-smoker or never smoker. To answer your question in terms of why this is the case, the honest answer is we don't know. There are various theories that have been put forth. I think what we do know is that, as Dr. Jamalul mentioned, you know, compared to the West in Asia, we definitely have, although still the majority of cases are in smokers or former smokers, there is proportionately more non-smokers here compared to in the West. When we look a bit further, we also see that within that cohort, women are overrepresented, unfortunately, and there is a higher genetic predisposition, what we call is these driver mutations, molecular mutations, seem to be higher in the lung cancers that are detected in Asia, including Malaysia, and certainly in the non-smoker and non-smoker. So I think we're starting to recognize that it's no longer just a male smoker's disease, it's no longer lower socioeconomic disease, as has been thought of in the past. You know, it is now starting to affect, it doesn't discriminate. We're starting to see more cases in the so-called never smoker, non-smoker. Obviously, other factors at play as well, you know, secondhand smoke, third-hand smoke, other risk factors as well need to be addressed. But we reckon a lot of that is a genetic predisposition.
So, meaning that the driving factor or the causative factor in most of the lung cancer among non-smokers is actually genetic mutations?
It seems to be the case, but you know, I guess sometimes you need an event, something that will trigger that process at a cellular level. One of the other theories, just to share as well, is, as I said, women are overrepresented in this group of so-called never non-smoker developing lung cancer. One of the theories put forth is high temperature wok cooking at home, you know, the inhalation of those cooking fumes or cooking vapors. So I think for, men or women who do a lot of wok cooking at home, one of the points we want to get across is, I think, firstly, be a bit more judicious. Maybe do that only a couple of times a week. make sure you have an extractive fan or have a well-ventilated kitchen. But these are all theories in terms of what may be the causation of the etiology of lung cancer in the non-smoker.
Dr. Jamalo, you wanted to add?
Yeah, just a couple more points actually regarding why, you know, we are seeing a rise of lung cancer among non-smokers, already mentioned by such as secondhand smoking, genetics and family history, other things like, you know, environmental factors, and air pollution, radon exposure, you know, asbestos exposure. So these are, you know, additional risk factors for lung cancer among non-smokers.
So, you know, before we go for a break, I want to bring up this point because, you know, all along, we advocate for people to stop smoking because, you know, lung cancer as the outcome is our main sort of weapon. And also the fact that they are exposing those around them to passive smoke. You know, would smokers turn around and say, and they already say it anyway, you know, you don't smoke also can get cancer, what? You know, what does this rise in lung cancer among non-smokers actually mean? Will it add fuel to the smokers' argument, Dr. Anand?
I mean, I think that's an interesting argument. You know, all diseases, including cancers and lung cancers, the causation, the etiology, right, is multifactorial. I mean, I think we all know people who smoke two packs of cigarettes a day for 40 years and nothing happens, and then you get someone who's never smoked and, you know, their whole life, and then they're diagnosed with lung cancer. So what we do know is the link between tobacco smoking and lung cancer and many other health conditions, but certainly between smoking and lung cancer, is well established for over half a century. So we have to, you know, it's the single most identifiable and preventable risk factor. And that's the one thing you can do to mitigate, to reduce the risk of lung cancer and other diseases, is to not smoke. Just on that point, if I can just go off a little bit, ironically or paradoxically, right, I think one of the problems with lung cancer is all of us, including doctors, we've associated this disease with smokers and mainly with men. And there's been the issue of lack of empathy. It's almost as if it's a self-inflicted disease. And paradoxically, I think it's going to take something as tragic as more non-smokers or never smokers, of which mostly are women, to be diagnosed with lung cancer for that stigma to go away and for the empathy to increase, perhaps go the way of breast cancer. But I think that argument that, hey, you know, you didn't smoke and you got lung cancer, no, we've got to fight that kind of very flawed way of thinking.
Yeah. And I think on that note, it also brings to mind whether a screening of other at-risk groups may have been missed out on because of the focus on smokers all this while. But we'll come back and talk a little bit more about, you know, how we can improve the sensitivity in screening then. Just very briefly about how treating lung cancer in non-smokers might be different, if at all, than treating it in smokers. I'm speaking today to Dr. Anand Sachitanandan, consultant cardiothoracic surgeon and president of the Lung Cancer Network Malaysia, and Dr. Jamalul Azizi, consultant pulmonologist from Hospital Serdang. We're discussing lung cancer. Primarily, I started by, looking at its burden in Malaysia, why it's rising among non-smokers. But of course, there's still a big proportion of lung cancer among smokers being the highest risk group right now in Malaysia. Do call us with your questions, 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be right back, so stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik, and my guest, the president of the Lung Cancer Network Malaysia, Dr. Anand Sachitanandan, and Dr. Jamalul Azizi, consultant pulmonologist from Hospital Serdang. We're discussing lung cancer, some more relatively recent trends in terms of an increase among non-smokers, why this might be the case, and we'll go on to look at improving screening really among the still higher risk group, which are the smokers, but other at-risk groups, which include the non-smokers as well. But first, Dr. Jamalul, is there a difference in the type, how lung cancer actually develops when it's in non-smokers? We've already talked about how sometimes it's due to a genetic mutation. Is it actually more serious? Would the treatment of lung cancer among non-smokers be different at all?
Right. Yes. First of all, the pattern of lung cancer, as I said, has changed over the last 10 years. Previously, we were seeing more of one type of lung cancer, which was called squamous cell carcinoma. But in the last 10 years, I think that the pattern has changed, where we are seeing a different type of histology. In both smokers and non-smokers, actually, and this type is it's adenocarcinoma type. Okay, so and this is nowadays the most common type of lung cancer in both actually smokers and non-smokers, compared to what 10 years ago when squamous cell carcinoma was the most common among smokers. So in terms of the treatment, in terms of you asked me whether is there any difference in lung cancer in non-smokers? Yeah, that was the question, was it? The difference is only the histology, actually. Previously it was squamous cell type. Nowadays it's more like adenocarcinoma type. So it's the different histology but the management. It's the same, actually. It depends on the type, on the staging, if it is an early stage lung cancer, adenocarcinoma, stage one or two, you refer to the surgeons, and if that adenocarcinoma is more advanced, you refer to the oncologist. So management-wise, there's no difference, actually, just the histology, has changed, over the last 10 years.
Has it had any impact, Dr. Anand, in terms of that late stage presentation that you talked about that is a big problem with lung cancer? Does this type that's changed from squamous to adenocarcinoma, has that made a difference in whether it can be picked up earlier or not?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, actually, shall we? Dr. Jamalul is right. The treatment is, it's yes and no when you say is the treatment different. Because as we've already established, lung cancer in the non-smoker and never-smoker, as Dr. Jamalul has just mentioned, is largely adenocarcinoma. And this type of tumor tends to present more in the periphery, meaning the outer surfaces of the lung, not always. For that reason, sometimes it can present a bit later. These sort of patients may be less likely to present with a troublesome cough or what we call as hemoptysis, which is coughing up blood. But the treatment for lung cancer, irrespective of the histology, is very much stage-dependent, is what Dr. Jamalul just mentioned. So we have to be very meticulous in how we stage the patient. Stage means we're trying to determine the extent of spread. So once a diagnosis has been established, they need to have a CT scan, a PET scan, sometimes an MRI of the brain, because we use the international classification called TNM, looking at the size and location of the tumor, whether there's lymph node involvement, whether there's spread process called metastases, if it is spread elsewhere. In lung cancer, it's commonly to the brain or bone or lymph nodes, the opposite lung. So based on the stage, irrespective of the histology, if it's early stage, as Dr. Jamalul mentioned, then surgery is usually the treatment of choice if the patient's fit enough. In terms of more advanced disease, then it's non-surgical, like chemotherapy or radiotherapy. The other point where it could and it appears to be slightly different is, as we mentioned earlier, we're starting to see more of these genetic or molecular mutations in the lung cancers or adenocarcinomas in the non-smoker, never-smoker. And here's a small silver lining in that, because there's a new group of drugs or treatments, which is referred to as targeted therapies, which is an oral therapy. They come under a category called TKIs, tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And these are drugs that they're not curative, but they have been shown to make a potential game changer. They can significantly alter the outcome in terms of what we call as disease-free survival or progression-free survival. Unfortunately, eventually the cancer is clever, and through mutations, resistance will occur. So, but we're getting, when I say we collectively, you know, pulmonologists like Dr. Jamalul, oncologists, and as surgeons as well, as a community, we're getting better at getting patients to live longer and with a better quality of life, but these treatments are still non-curative. And the slight downside is they are, you know, financial toxicity. They're very expensive treatments. But it is a new category of drugs which seem to be working quite well, and these cancers are more amenable to targeted therapies.
So if we really want to address improving outcomes of lung cancer, we need to look at picking them up earlier. That brings me to a question about screening, Dr. Jamalul. What have been the challenges of screening people for lung cancer as early as possible? And does an increase in lung cancer among non-smokers add more complexity to that process?
Right. An interesting question, because I was directly involved in a local study. It was a feasibility study. You asked me about the challenges faced in lung cancer screening in Malaysia. It was a study that I was personally involved as the principal investigator. We call it PEARL study, P-E-A-R-L. We were offering low-dose CT scan to our patients who were at risk for lung cancer, you know, those who were heavy smokers, 20 to 30 pack years, you know, above certain age, you know, et cetera. But this is the challenge that we face. We did the study, 2 or 3 years ago, and poor response from the public, from the heavy smoker. The reason I can only speculate, some of the reasons were because maybe they were very well, you know, because early stage lung cancer has no symptom. They were very well. And then we were providing the low-dose CT scan service for free, but, you know, very, very poor response. And the other reason was perhaps they were scared, you know, with the diagnosis of lung cancer, you know, if it was picked up on the CT scan. And they were not willing to undergo, you know, the biopsy procedure, you know, if it was picked up on low-dose CT scan. So this is a big challenge that we have in Malaysia. Unlike, the big study that was conducted in the U.S., a multi-center, what was called National Lung Screening Trial, you know, thousands of people, you know, our publics are different, you know. And so, because so many people were involved in the lung cancer screening trial, National Lung Screening Trial in the U.S., they came up with, you know, good data to show that, you know, low-dose CT scan can reduce mortality, you know, and can pick up early-stage lung cancer. So, I mean, that's the challenge we face. Yeah? And I'm personally disappointed, actually, because of the poor response from the public. We provided free parking for them.
Maybe you need to provide food. So we have the tool. And we know it works. Low-dose CT scans can pick up early lung cancer and can reduce the likelihood of deaths. Of course, we need to get people to come forward and do it. Dr. Anand, your thoughts?
No, I think, you know, that's... You've summed it up nicely there. We have the technology, and it's proven, low-dose CT. It's widely available in all major government hospitals, all private hospitals across the country. Just to share with the listeners, when you talk about a low-dose CT scan, in comparison to a conventional CT scan, it does what it says on the tin. It is low-dose, low-radiation dose. You don't need to fast. You don't need a prior blood test. Nobody is going to stick any cannula in your hand. You can just walk into any major hospital and have that. We advocate that group, you know, 45 to 75, who's been smoking at least 20 years or more. But as Dr. Jamalul said, the problem is the majority of smokers are still guys. Maybe guys, you know, are less, more averse to health-seeking behavior. And the whole premise of screening means you're not really a patient, you're a person or a population. So you're not unwell, you haven't got symptoms. So sometimes it's a hard sell. trying to convince someone that, you know, but the evidence and data is very strong, Sherry, that, you know, it is truly life-saving in terms of reducing the lung cancer-specific mortality. So, I mean, for us, it tells me that LCNM and other NGOs, our work is cut out for us. We have to continue to persevere with awareness and educational and advocacy activities, not be patronizing to the public, but, you know, demonstrate to them, look, if you are in this particular at-risk group, then this can really make a change, you know, trying to detect the disease earlier when it can be treated more effectively.
So that's between the ages 45 to 75, if you've been smoking for 20 years or more. Is that right? Screening is encouraged in those groups?
Yeah. I mean, what we have done, to be honest, is, as Dr. Jamal mentioned, there's two major international trials. One is the National Lung Screening Trial, NLST, which was about a decade ago. And more recently, when I say recently, it's already 3 or 4 years ago, the European trial called NELSON. And these two trials are multi-centered, randomized trials, which is the highest level of scientific evidence in medicine that you can hope to acquire. And it's provided compelling evidence, unequivocal evidence on the efficacy and in terms of the life-saving, you know, benefit of screening high-risk populations. So what we have done is we've extrapolated from that sort of baseline and incorporated Malaysian data in terms of our own epidemiology, what is the age-specific incidence rate of lung cancer in Malaysia. We know the incidence under the age of 40 is very low, it's less than 5%. We know it starts to go up after the age of 45 and peaks around the mid-60s. And of course, we have to look at the life expectancy of Malaysians, you know, in this country. So in America, they may keep screening into the 80s and 90s, perhaps it's less relevant here. So we've kind of, you know, it's not an exact science, but the guidelines, after all, they are guidelines. So that's what we advocate. You know, 45 years of age to 75, a significant smoking history. Either you're a current smoker or a former smoker of at least 20 pack years. You know, that means you've been smoking a pack a day for at least 20 years or packs a day for 10 years. Yeah.
Dr. Jamalul, what about screening for non-smokers?
That's an interesting question. All right. Okay, I mean, the evidence is very strong with regard to screening, you know, for lung cancer in, the, you know, in smokers, you know, in who are at risk for lung cancer. But, you know, I've been looking for the evidence, actually, you know. The problem, as I say, you know, we don't have local data, you know, not even feasibility data, you know, to support low dose CT scan, even in high group population, heavy smokers, no, okay, and we know that, you know, lung cancer, you know, there is a significant proportion of non-smokers, you know, who will develop lung cancer, you know, but if you look at the, you know, the practice in the US, you know, when I search for it, you know, low dose CT scan is not advocated in the US and in the US as well. But when I, when, you know, I search for, you know, some evidence in Japan, they actually advocate low dose CT scan in non-smokers. All right, but in Malaysia, I really don't know because we don't have any preliminary data to support, you know, the use of low dose CT scan. You know, to detect cancer in non-smokers. Mm. I don't know.
Yeah. So that's the lack of evidence. But, you know, we have a listener, Hamdu, and his point is this, sadly, sorry, Hamdu, I'm not sure. Hamdu says, we lost a dear one to lung cancer 3 years ago. He had never smoked in his life, was in his early 50s. He was diagnosed at stage 3, passed on within 3 months after some treatment, had never been hospitalized at all. So he's, you know, can we give him an answer to his question, which is how do we get tested or screened for something like this, given that you assume never having smoked, you wouldn't be considered at risk at all, Dr. Anand?
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult because, you know, the whole premise of screening, as we all know, is to pick up a disease, in this case, lung cancer, before you develop symptoms, right? And for screening to work, we're talking about screening populations. So it has to be cost effective. For it to be cost effective, for it to be impactful, you have to target an at-risk group. So for smokers, I think there's clear evidence. We have different problems trying to convince smokers to come for screening. For the gentleman who's called in, and what we're talking here, but mainly the non-smoker, never smoker. There is some data in Asia, it's just come out recently from Taiwan. There's a trial called Talent. Because Taiwan is a bit like Singapore, high proportion of non-smokers and never smokers in their cohort of lung cancer patients. And what they showed, Cherik, is that, you know, I guess you could call them a high-risk never smoker, non-smoker. That's the person who has a significant family history of lung cancer. And that study showed quite eloquently that the more first-degree relatives you had or who had lung cancer, the greater your risk. It almost went up exponentially. So if you had, you know, siblings or an uncle or parent with lung cancer, then that risk went up. So, but outside that, we still don't have strong evidence. Perhaps it is not unreasonable for someone, irrespective, say you're a non-smoker, but there's a significant family history, you should, as at the very least, you know, have a discussion with your pulmonologist, with your chest physician or your GP. Initiate that discussion because that, you know, that scan, that low-dose CT scan may just save your life. Yeah.
And, you know, just judging by the messages that we have coming in, one more listener who said that they lost their loved one to lung cancer as well, also never a smoker. And, you know, they would like more from Ministry of Health in terms of, you know, the data on cancer cases, more evidence on its presence in non-smokers, more promotion of free public screening as well. You know, we'll come back and continue the discussion. There's still more to cover, but keep those messages coming in. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or call us at 03-773-2900. I'm speaking to Dr. Anand Sachitanandan, consultant cardiothoracic surgeon and president of the Lung Cancer Network Malaysia, and Dr. Jamalul Azizi, consultant pulmonologist from Hospital Serdang. We'll be right back, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shaoik, and my guests, Dr. Jamalul Azizi, consultant pulmonologist from Hospital Serdang, and Dr. Anand Sachitanandan, consultant cardiothoracic surgeon and president of the Lung Cancer Network Malaysia. We're discussing lung cancer. And, you know, we have spent quite a fair bit of time looking at the lesser known risk group, which is the non-smokers, and why it's increasing among non-smokers. The challenge, the real difficulty of picking it up early among smokers as well as non-smokers. We have a question here from Muhammad Shahani, who asks, should individuals exposed to secondhand smoke, you know, who have family members or colleagues who smoke, be encouraged to go for screening? So should passive smokers be encouraged to go for screening? Dr. Anand?
Yeah. Yes, to me, yeah. The answer is yes. Yeah. But talking about screening for lung cancer in public hospitals, you know, just a statement from me, because I'm working in a government hospital, as I put it there in the chat box there, because, you know, the nature of public hospitals in Malaysia, they are just super busy, overstretched. We are unable to provide low-dose CT scan to detect, you know, early lung cancer. You know, I have to, you know, apologize for that actually. But they are, you know, but they are encouraged, you know, to get the, you know, low dose CT scan elsewhere, in private hospital. This is available easily. So unfortunately, our public hospital are just overwhelmed, you know, actually, and we are unable to provide, you know, low-dose CT scan.
So, Dr. Anand, what are the options for people to get screening?
Yeah, if I can just go back a minute, Sherry, the listener's question was about whether, you know, if you're exposed to secondhand smoke, passive smoke, should you get screened? You know, it's a very good point, because I think that there is clearly, you know, some proportion of those so-called non-smokers or never-smokers who get lung cancer. It is cumulative exposure to secondhand smoke or third-hand smoke over, you know, many, many years, either at the workplace or they may have a spouse who's been smoking. The difficulty is, how do we quantify, you know, the secondhand or passive smoking? And that's very difficult. You know, we've banned smoking in the eateries, but, you know, I don't know, my own personal observation in the last few months around the pandemic and recently is enforcement is very lackadaisical, and I see people now smoking within the, you know, the perimeter.
Absolutely.
injuries, which is very disappointing. The other thing, just slightly off the point here, is also recently I think they're going to potentially tax e-cigarettes and vaping, which, whilst that will generate revenue, it's also inadvertently almost legitimizing this habit, which I think it could be a gateway into conventional tobacco smoking. So a bit disappointed with that. But, you know, how do we screen? I think we know that low-dose CT imaging is the way to go, definitely for the smoker and former smoker that is high risk. Perhaps, you know, we have to wait for more evidence, but I think there's already some evidence from that Taiwanese study that if you are, you know, a high-risk non-smoker, which I would define as someone with a significant family history, perhaps more than one first-degree relative with lung cancer, please go and see a doctor and initiate a discussion. In terms of biomarkers, something that Dr. Chamalu and I often get asked in our practice, you know, most clinicians get asked. In Malaysia, you can walk into any hospital and request tumor markers. They're not good enough for the purpose of screening for lung cancer at the moment. Sometimes it helps with the diagnosis to stratify, a finding on the CT scan. But it's mainly being used, Cherry, for patients for surveillance, for response to treatment, be it surgery or other treatments, or to monitor for recurrence or relapse in patients where the baseline tumor marker was elevated. Mm. But they are non-specific, and in the vast majority of people with lung cancer, the tumor marker is normal. So really, it still falls back to identifying an at-risk or high-risk group and offering them or counselling them for screening.
All right. And Lung Cancer Network Malaysia is piloting the use of artificial intelligence in screening. Dr. Anand, can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, so this is something we're really excited about. You know, AI technology, I think, is a potential game changer in many industries, including healthcare. So we are exploring the potential of this technology in trying to enhance and expedite the diagnosis of lung cancer at a community level. You know, we're working with a chain of GP clinics. And how it works is basically, currently, if someone were to go and visit their doctor for whatever reason, and if the doctor, he or she felt they needed, based on the examination and history, they needed a chest x-ray, then they would proceed to do one. And then the x-ray would take, you know, it would be several days before you got the report back from the radiologist. And it would necessitate another visit by the patient, you know, and then management will follow accordingly. So under this project, utilizing AI technology, what happens is the patient will have the x-ray as per the recommendation of the GP if it's deemed appropriate. And whether it's a conventional analog chest x-ray, shall we, or whether it's a digital chest x-ray, it will then get uploaded to the cloud. And then the software, the technology, it's a deep learning algorithm, it's machine learning. They're able to, analyze the x-ray in this case. But you can apply it to a low-dose CT scan as well. But on this project, it's a simple chest x-ray. And it will generate a report within a couple of minutes, back in the hand of the GP. So, you know, there's a wealth of evidence now that some of these technologies can enhance diagnostic accuracy, you know, possibly even outperform a very experienced, trained thoracic chest radiologist. What we are hoping to do is work with radiologists. I see this as not, competing, but complementary, to enhance the diagnostic accuracy and to expedite that whole diagnostic referral pathway. In other words, what we want to do is shorten the interval between when a person first goes to see their GP with either for a routine checkup or with, you know, possible symptoms, and shorten the interval between that time point, that initial time point, and when a firm diagnosis is established and definitive treatment can start. Because we know, you know, it's very much time dependent. And the feedback from the GPs, the group that we're working with, is they like it very much. They're getting a detailed report in hand in a matter of minutes. We've done almost 3,000 screenings so far. Roughly 14-15%, the technology will identify some abnormality. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a lung nodule or lung cancer. Some of it is confounded with other things. It could be pneumonias, unfortunately COVID in the current climate, TB, etc. And I think what it'll do is it'll help the radiologists rather than disrupt or displace them. It'll help them because, you know, looking for cancer, especially early stage disease on an x-ray, can be very labor intensive. And with this software technology, maybe they can hone in and look in greater detail on the x-ray that the AI software has identified as being abnormal or having an anomaly. So we're quite excited about that. Cost can sometimes be an issue with any emerging technology, but this is scalable. And if we can demonstrate, it's really a feasibility pilot study. if this this is feasible in Malaysia at a community level, then potentially it can be scaled up. You know, with the economy of scale, you bring down the costs. This is not to replace the low-dose CT scan. That is the gold standard. This is just for people who go to their GP for some other reason and then need a chest X-ray based on the GP's evaluation. We hope to, you know, increase that yield, the diagnostic pickup, incidental pickup of a lung cancer.
Yeah. That sounds terribly exciting. And, you know, cost incurred here, but we're looking at savings in terms of treating late-stage disease later on down the line, right? Just very quickly, we don't have much time left, Dr. Jamalul, but I'd like to get your observations about the impact of COVID-19 on lung cancer, whether we are seeing a potential worsening of outcomes.
Thank you very much, Xiaoying. So I'll try to be very brief here. So it is a real impact, actually, you know, and it's my personal experience, actually. After, I can't remember, it was last year, after the second or third wave, you know, when, you know, we were advising everyone to stay home, you know, and the COVID got better a bit, I think we were seeing, you know, suspected lung cancer patient being referred to us, and I saw myself, the impact of COVID there. You know, many of these patients presented late, you know, and I remember clearly one young lady, who had presented very late, you know, to us, you know, and because she was staying at home during COVID, and she, when she came and saw me in the clinic, it was already advanced, you know. It's you know, devastating to me. You know, she cried, you know, in front of me. It's just, you know, I just can't imagine it, actually. And that's the impact of COVID, you know, late presentation of lung cancer. I can't say more than that. It's just devastating to me. Actually.
Absolutely. So, Dr. Anand, what does that tell us about us catching up now in order to catch the backlog, if you want to call it that?
Yeah, no, I think absolutely, you know, COVID's disrupted all our lives, isn't it? All sectors of the economy, including healthcare, provision of cancer services and treatments. You know, cancer is one of those diseases, timely diagnosis and treatment is imperative, you know, for a good outcome. And it doesn't wait, you know, the cancer progression from early to late stage will happen. There's data from India, from Spain, the US, UK, they're going to see more late stage cases, and there's no reason not to expect the same in Malaysia. It'll come, unfortunately, probably in the next 12 to 18 months. As it is, we're already burdened with late-stage disease, even pre-pandemic. So unfortunately, we can expect to see more for the reasons that Dr. Jamalul mentioned, you know, disruptions to scheduled appointments, surgeries have been postponed, etc. I mean, to answer your question, Shariq, in terms of how we address that, well, there were some good things with COVID. There was good collaboration between the public and private hospitals. I hope that can be a framework to build, you know, greater, you know, collaboration and integration so we can tackle the backlog, the waiting times, the waiting list for treatments, because cancer needs, you know, timely treatment. Another thing is we adopted, you know, telemedicine technology to do more remote consultations, a bit like today's discussion. And we can triage patients, you know, and as we're opening up the economy, hopefully medical tourism is a big revenue earner for this country. You know, we can even use telemedicine, you know, to conduct consultations and evaluations. So I think that's very important as well. But really, there has to be the political will for us to, you know, get appropriate funding. What I would like to see, I think, you know, COVID's shown all countries, including Malaysia, that, you know, if you have poor governance or if you have chronic underinvestment in public healthcare, then, you know, we have seen what's happened everywhere. We're no different. And we need to spend a greater proportion of our GDP on healthcare, you know. And obviously, selfishly, I would like some of that to be ring-fenced for cancer services and in particular lung cancer. You know, part of the wish list is taxation on tobacco products. Maybe some of that can be set aside, ring-fenced for screening and treatments of lung cancer, which is a very, very curable disease if picked up early.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that you know, one day Dr. Jamalo, you'll come back on the show and you'll give us the good news that low-dose CT scan, you know, for screening is available in the public sector. That would be fantastic in terms of really turning the tide around, wouldn't it? But thank you so much for your time, both of you, and for what you've shared today. Okay. I've been speaking to Dr. Anand Sachidanandan, consultant cardiothoracic surgeon and president of the Lung Cancer Network Malaysia, and Dr. Jamalo Azizi, consultant pulmonologist from Hospital Serdang. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.